Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about the career of Katharine Hepburn, a woman with a really, really great backstory. Where do you want to start with Kate, Mike?
Well, the place to start is to show that she was such a strong personality, so distinctive. And her family origins have a lot to do with that. Her very much out of New England, specifically Hartford, Connecticut. Her father was a well-regarded surgeon. Her mother was an early advocate for birth control, socially progressive, strongly opinionated. Gosh, I think there's something in the gene pool there, you know? She really gets them. And she really then, when she becomes a stage actor already, she's really asserting herself. She occasionally will get into trouble for that, you know, in terms of how she handles a role or how she works with other people or doesn't work very well. A local footnote is that her early stage career included actually appearing in plays in Baltimore in 1928, you know, at least one production here. And so she really, you know, carries that with her from the get-go, that she's her own person. And in terms of the image she cuts, the way she dresses, the way she behaves, she's like that as a very young actress on stage and then makes her first Hollywood film in 1932, A Bill of Divorcement, opposite John Barrymore. And then let me hand off to you at this point, because in that early to mid-30s period, she makes a number of films worth mentioning.
Yeah, and I think the classic is Little Women, and she plays Jo. I think the Jo by which all further Jos have been judged, because she fits that role so perfectly. The girl that is, you know, sort of a tomboy and a writer and an intellectual and unafraid of what people think. So she does a absolutely fantastic job in that movie. And I think it sort of defines her image for the rest of her career. What do you think, Mike?
It does really, because when you think about Little Women, you just think of how, you know, she's really got that assertive personality and she's just not going to take any guff. You know, she doesn't take any, you know, she really just puts herself out there as a smart and a freely speaking person. And even though that's got like literary underpinnings in terms of adaptations, for her other movies that are more contemporary in setting and so on, they're congruent, you know, it's really of a piece with what she's doing. And Little Women's 1933, in that same time period, you know, same year, films like Morning Glory, for which she wins her first Academy Award, a number of other films like Christopher Strong, Alice Adams, all made in the mid-30s, where you really see that, you know, she's very much a modern woman. You know, Little Women, things like that, talk about more as period pieces, but still there's that sense of a modern sensibility there. And then you really start to get it in terms of, I know you love to talk about the great outfits that these actresses have, and I do too, but the, you know, the fact that, you know, she was, you know, wearing slacks at a time when, you know, other than Marlene Dietrich, you know, it wasn't something that women typically did in Hollywood. But, and some of the roles do have, should I say, mannish qualities? I mean, it's a sort of loaded statement, but you know what I'm getting at? The fact that she's going against some of the gender stereotypes, gender norms, if you will, and showing that, well, you know, women can wear pants, if you will. I know she hated to hear them referred to as pants. They were always slacks.
Right, slacks. There's a difference, apparently.
I know there's a difference. I know she would give me a mean look if she'd heard me say that. But you know what I'm getting at is the fact that
she is definitely behaving as a woman who is wearing the pants in every sense of the word. But of course, in Bringing Up Baby, it's kind of a goofy role that she plays, which is fun. It's fun to see her play that role. It's even better when she gets to 1940 and does The Philadelphia Story, which I think is the movie most people associate with her, because it looks like she's playing herself.
Yes, thank you. When I mentioned that those origins, I mean that, you know, she's from New England aristocracy, essentially, of a liberal bent, you know, college is Bryn Mawr. I mean, she's very much, and so that's very close. New England's up a bit, but it's close in some ways to like mainline Philadelphia. And so with The Philadelphia Story, there, she really, you know, she was actually, I don't want to say on the skids, but her movies in the mid to late 30s, some did well at the box office, some of them did not. She was tagged box office poison along with some other actresses of that era. And not entirely fairly, but it stuck. And she was worried about her career. So what she did was she went back to the theater. She went to Broadway with Philip Barry play The Philadelphia Story. And as an indication of how smart she is as a businesswoman as much as an actor, she waived her salary for a cut of the profits, which were considerable. She ended up making a lot of money off that. Moreover, she acquired the movie rights and sold them to MGM. And she, Katharine Hepburn, was the one who chose the director. And she was the one who also was responsible for, and the director is George Cukor, so she's starting at the top, but also she was responsible for the casting of Cary Grant and James Stewart. In other words, she was in the driver's seat. She controlled that film. The film was a big box office hit, and she got an Oscar nomination, and it really gave like a second wind, if I can put it that way, to a career that was, at least in Hollywood commercial terms, faltering a little bit just before that.
We should mention that Philadelphia Story also has Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart in it. I mean, how can you possibly go wrong with a cast like that? And if you do decide to watch the Philadelphia Story, same year, there was another Philadelphia Story, which is Kitty Foyle with Ginger Rogers in a dramatic role, not a dancing role, although she does dance. It's not a theatrical sort of performance. But the contrast between the two worlds is really striking, you know, between the upper class of the world that Katharine Hepburn embodies in A Philadelphia Story versus Kitty Foyle and life on the other side of the tracks.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at those two actresses because Ginger Rogers had been so closely associated, of course, with Fred Astaire and usually, you know, not quite second billing, but the fact that she was, you know, dancing along with him. I mean, he was taking the lead, although she was having to do it, you know, backwards in high heels, as the joke went, which is no small feat. But the fact that because she was in all those light musical comedies with Fred Astaire, she wanted to prove herself as a serious actress. And she definitely did, you know, in that film. So you have actresses like that who are well enough along in their career that they're starting to recalibrate, if you know what I mean. They're starting to think about ways to, you know, rejuvenate, get back in the game, if you will. Not that they'd fallen out completely, but trying to move into whatever that next phase would be. And in Katharine Hepburn's case, because Bring Up Baby and Philadelphia Story, films like that, have so much screwball comedy in them, that quick banter, that interplay, you know, battle of the sexes kind of stuff, those will segue quite perfectly into all the movies that she ended up making with Spencer Tracy.
You know, some of them also have a theme of remarriage in them as an ongoing theme in these screwball comedies, where, you know, you were married to them and then you're divorced, but now maybe you're going to marry them again, or maybe something went wrong with the paperwork, so maybe you're not married. This theme comes up all the time in these movies. Isn't that an interesting sort of thing to highlight, Mike?
Well, I think one reason for it is the fact that in Hollywood, you worry about the censors. And, you know, the production code and the Hollywood production code wasn't crazy about divorce as a phenomenon, right? And so if somebody was divorced, the production code, that office, the Hayes office, would probably be happiest if you could somehow find a way to remarry. And so that's a pragmatic way there. But also people, audiences like happy endings, right? So, you know, this is the person you should be married to.
Well, that brings me to what happened after the Philadelphia Story was a run of movies where she played opposite Spencer Tracy, which was a magical pairing and a romantic one as well, although she never spoke about it until after his wife had passed.
What's quite interesting here is that within Hollywood, it was an open secret. Outside of Hollywood, people generally just didn't know. And for all those years, Spencer Tracy had married his wife back in, I want to say 1928, but I mean, they've been married for a long, long time. And he and Hepburn were an item for decades, and he essentially had two lives. He had his wife and children and so on, the family life there, but then he and Hepburn would oftentimes live together, a kind of schedule, like two households kind of schedule. And it was such an arrangement, and I'm not sure if the wife approved of it, but somehow there was an accommodation, because very late in life, as Spencer Tracy was really seriously ill, as they're making guests coming to dinner, that end phase of his career, who took care of him? Who did the nursing and so on? Katharine Hepburn and Tracy's wife alternated, you know, in terms of like, well, I'll take today, you take tomorrow kind of thing. So they had a kind of arrangement. You know, life is complicated sometimes, right? You know, he's long married, and yet he's having this long-standing affair with Kate. And, you know, Katharine Hepburn really, you know, she didn't like talking about her personal life during that period. In her later years, she wrote several autobiographical books. And there it's a different matter. There she really does open up freely about her life with Spencer Tracy. But if you go back to like the 1940s and 50s and 60s, she didn't like to give interviews for the most part. And she just didn't like to talk about those personal things.
What's interesting about this time period, and what's worth talking about, is that the divorce taboo was very real. movies that came out like Indiscreet with Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant, where there's a statement made that they cannot get divorced, and it's simply just not discussed. And today that would seem very hard to understand why people would be so rigid about something that has now become so easily accepted. But the Spencer Tracy Hepburn pairing was great. I can't think of a single couple, and I don't mean that they have to be a romantic couple, where people would pay to go see those two people in a movie, in a contemporary movie, a contemporary film, over and over again.
It's personality-driven acting. And so the two of them are like sparring partners. So each movie was almost like the next round in a boxing match. So it really is. So when you start thinking about movies like, Pat and Mike and so on, the two of them just keep batting it back and forth there. And audiences really, go to see the two of them together, that on-screen charisma they had. And is it even acting at a certain point? I mean, if he says something snappy and she has a kind of wicked smile by way of response, that's probably their usual breakfast table conversation.
How much of the way they behaved do you think was a holdover from the days of the studio basically running your life and creating a persona for you that was carefully maintained in the magazines of the day, et cetera?
It's a great question and not an easy one to answer necessarily, because both Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn were very strong-willed people, And so even though the studios typically tried to shape the actors, control the image and so on, the images they had, I see it, they're personality-driven actors, but those are their real personalities as I take them. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem like a studio fabrication. It doesn't seem like studio artifice. This is what you'll be. No, this is what they are and what they bring to the roles. It's one reason why Hepburn in particular, would often spar, and not at all in a funny way, with producers, directors, publicists, this and that. She does what she's going to do. I'll give a story from very late in her life. I had seen her on stage a couple times. Later in life, she was in some stage plays, which would appear in Washington and Baltimore and so on. And I remember talking with the owner of, not the owner, but rather the managing director of the Morris Mechanic Theater, which was a touring Broadway house in Baltimore, since demolished. But anyway, Hepburn was coming in to do a play there, and the managing director of the theater told me the story that it was, cold weather, and ordinarily, if you're the theater's manager, you want to have the right amount of heat in the theater for your audience, right? All 1,600 people. But Hepburn didn't like a theater too warm. She liked to have a cold theater, particularly up on stage with all the lights on. So she insisted that the heat be turned down and almost off, so that she'd be comfortable on stage. Meantime, people out in the theater seats had their coats wrapped around them because it was really cold in that theater, but she dictated what it should be like on stage there. So, I mean, that was once when she was in a play in Baltimore. Another time in, I think it was in Washington, she did plays like West Side Waltz and A Matter of Gravity and so on. And she was in the middle of, a scene, and some audience member must have been talking to a seatmate, whatever, and very close to the front of the stage. Hepburn broke character and reprimanded that person in the audience and then just stared and then went back to playing the role. So I mentioned those things because those were the times when I actually would have seen her. I mean, to see her on stage very late in her life and that absolute command of personality. Some of the plays weren't that great, but she was in them. And then the final story, the only other time I saw her was the year she received the Kennedy Center Honors. You make the grand entrance into the Kennedy Center, and then, all of us standing off to the side watching, and usually everyone's all glammed up, all sorts of, fancy dresses and so on. In her case, she was wearing what looked like a ratty old house coat that she just put on because she didn't really want to be there particularly. For many years, the Kennedy Center had asked her to be a recipient of the Kennedy Center Honors. But the proviso, the catch is you have to show up in person to receive it. They're not going to send it in the mail to you, right? So for many years, like the Kennedy Center Honors have been around, for decades, and she was always at the top of the list of people they wanted to honor, but she would always say no. I mean, she won 4 Academy Awards as Best Actress for Morning Glory, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Lion and Winner, On Golden Pond, and she had 8 more nominations, but she wasn't one to go to the ceremonies. You know what I mean? She accepted those statues, but oftentimes like not in person, she wouldn't be there for it. So she didn't want to go to the Kennedy Center to pick this thing up. And so she wasn't accepted. And they finally prevailed on, I think it was Dorothy Loudon, her actress friend, Kate Hepburn just keeps saying no to us. can you get through to her? And Hepburn, in her distinctive personality, listen to her friend Loudon and say, please accept it. You just have to go and pick it up. And Hepburn on the phone with Loudon uttered an expletive and sort of like, okay, I'll do it. You know, like then slam down the phone. So when I did actually see her in Washington, for somebody, well up in age, she still was Katharine Hepburn. I mean, commanding figure. But I swear to goodness, she had on this sort of like house coat she was wearing, almost like if you're going out to shovel snow or something, right? And she had that on over her dress. And it was so funny that way. But that's how she could be. I mean, she just, she was just going to do things her way. And it had to be like that.
Well, as radical as she was also really great at playing the school marm or the uptight missionary, which is the role that she played in 1951's African Queen with Humphrey Bogart, which I think is one of the unsung gems of her career. I think that's a really strong performance where you believe in the chemistry between them. She's great at stealing scenes, but also playing off, another big name actor like Bogart.
See, that's a point in her career where, again, Hollywood can be unforgiving in terms of not just actors, but particularly actresses as they get older. And that's a whole separate discussion we've had sort of piecemeal. But in Hepburn's case, by the 50s, she's a really mature person, right? So, she's not going to, in stereotypical terms, get like glamorous leading roles. Not that she often played glamour, but I'm getting at to play that kind of. So in the early to mid 50s, in The African Queen in 1951, in Summertime in 1955, she plays spinsters. She's going to play a upper middle-aged woman who's really tough-minded and not married or never attached, however you want to put that. But she gets roles like that and she plays them well. And then she knew how to run with that sense of really tough, difficult characters. The spinsters aren't, I don't want to make them seem unsympathetic, but they are strong-willed people and are just not attached for various reasons. And certainly in African Queen, she and Bogart are going to have a lot of sparring back and forth in terms of personality conflicts. But then later, a little bit later in her career, she turns to literary works and theater works because she's a woman of the theater as much as of the big screen. Tennessee Williams for Suddenly Last Summer in 1959, Eugene O'Neill for Long Day's Journey Into Night in 1962. And she's appearing in movie versions of some really great plays. So she's really savvy that way in terms of, because earlier in her career, look, she'd taken Philadelphia Story, right? Take a stage play and make a movie version. She always knew how to pick material. Let me put it that way. I mean, there are very few duds in the sense of why'd she pick that movie, why that role, whatever. Almost always you can see the intelligence there as to why she would do a particular role.
Well, she was an avowed feminist. And if you are interested in comparing a couple of her movies for a feminist viewpoint in terms of how women are portrayed, how she is portraying women in the story of a married woman, 1942's Woman of the Year is very, very different from the 60s when she does Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, both with Spencer Tracy. And in the first one, she's very brash and, puts her feet up on the table, just very, openly aggressive. But the role she plays in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is very much the supportive wife. I think she even makes reference to Spencer Tracy's career in that movie as being something she felt personally responsible for as well. It was their success. She had been, subsumed by her marriage with Spencer Tracy, but not really a passive character. I don't know if Kate could do a passive character, but just a very, very different portrayal of a married woman in two movies throughout her career with Spencer Tracy.
I think that becomes a more extended discussion as to, even though she's so strong-willed and this and that, you still have to think about social conventions. In terms of, earlier we talked about comedies of marriage and divorce and remarriage, if you will, but it's a kind of curious thing because you can be a strong-willed person, you can be a feminist and so on, but at some point you are working within a Hollywood studio system in terms of, what's expected by way of scripts and outcomes and so on. And we could almost go film by film there in terms of, not that the films are internally conflicted, but the fact that there are considerations there. I mean, these are movies made in the 1940s and 50s.
It just occurred to me that it would be interesting if it was the same couple from Woman of the Year that many years later. That would have been an interesting way to have made that second movie, would be to have revisited those characters and then cast them in that setting.
Well, I agree with you, but in some ways, with the various films you made with Spencer Tracy, you can work variations on relationships. And so you don't actually remake or redo, but in some ways you kind of revisit it.
So, what did you think of her award-winning performance in On Golden Pond?
I'm not a big fan of that film. I'd seen the original Broadway play, which was kind of schmaltzy but enjoyable. But I think the film is honey-hued in a way. It's got a kind of golden aura to it, where it's kind of sentimental in a way. And it's honest and earned sentiment. We were talking about Jane Fonda on an earlier episode. And certainly to have, Jane Fonda acting with her dad, Henry Fonda, and to have Katharine Hepburn as the third principal. There's a lot of Hollywood history there in the frame, right? And it is moving that way. But there are times where expression I use is it leans on the material. You know what I mean? It's just like there's sentiment there, but I think it tips into sentimentality. And that sort of golden-hued or honey-hued cinematography sometimes, where the pond itself, if you will, it's so pretty, it's so attractive. It's like postcard imagery sometimes, and it's kind of treacly. And I'm using a lot of words like that to show that, I'm not a huge fan of the film, but I acknowledge when that was made in 1981, that it is occurring, at the very end of Henry Fonda's career. And certainly, well along in Hepburn. So I can certainly appreciate it as a Hollywood cognizant film. It's really evoking their histories as actors as much as, the material itself. But, it was well received commercially and critically. And she does, after all, win an Academy Award for it. It's right up there with the major films she made. I don't think it's one of the best films she made, but certainly one of the major films.
Probably the best way to know more about Hepburn is to read her own words about herself. She wrote an autobiography and just entitled it Me, which is, I really can't imagine her coming up with any other sort of title that would have been more perfect. But some of the things you finding out about her backstory is, what a tomboy she really was growing up. She apparently liked to be called Jimmy. And ladies, we do have her to thank for slacks being a part of our lives once she had figured out that she liked wearing them and they were more comfortable and more practical. She just simply wasn't having it that people were going to criticize her for that. She just didn't care what people thought. And I think that's one of the threads that goes through all of her movies is that she does come back to that confidence that everybody wishes that they possessed. And she just brings that out in every single role.
Well, I love the fact that that 1992 memoir is entitled Me. There's no doubt that she's at the center of it. And that strong will, that strong ego. One anecdote from her later years is she lived in a townhouse in Manhattan, Turtle Bay, which is near the United Nations, like a ritzy neighborhood. And for years, she would complain about her next door neighbor, that the guy was always, playing the piano late at night, and it was bothering her. And she was the sort of person who would like open a window and shout, like, turn it down or shut it off. Really blunt that way. Well, the next door neighbor she was complaining about, the guy at the piano, was Stephen Sondheim, and she just, yeah, I know it's hilarious.
Pipe down over
I
there.
mean, if I had Stephen Sondheim playing the piano next door, I'd want to put my ear to the wall and hear it. But her response was, turn it down. It's too late to be playing the piano.
See, there's the schoolmarm. She can bring her out when she needs her. So, Mike, what would you say was her best movie, and which one would you say was a hidden gem?
It's really difficult to isolate just, one film. I mean, maybe I'll cheat a little bit in the sense of I think early in her career, there are films like Bringing Up Baby and The Philadelphia Story that really are on a kind of equal level in terms of showcasing her talent as a younger actor. So I'm cheating in the sense of trying to get at least two or three film titles in there. As you move into that middle phase of the career, I would think something like African Queen. Is a strong example. Get a little further in, and suddenly Last Summer, A Long Day's Journey, and Tonight. There really are strong films there. Very late in the career, the films aren't always as strong and don't hold up, I think, quite as well. But in terms of personality, certainly Lion in Winter, is a strong assertion of the personality. And likewise, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which I use in a course I teach about African Americans in film. I don't think it's a great film, but it's a fascinating film in terms of zeitgeist, where Hollywood was at that point, where American society was in terms of race relations. And there, when you see her and Spencer Tracy, you really get a sense of how in their final years together, the complete devotion they had for each other. So if I single out a film like that, it's not because it's a particularly great film, but within the career, it's special.
I would have to say that probably her most defining role was Little Women, because she is so much like the character that she plays. It's almost like she's playing herself. And like I said, I think she at least appears to be playing herself in The Philadelphia Story, which is, of course, a very strong movie for her. But I would say the hidden gem would be Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And partly I say that in case people are, you know, only going to pick a couple of them and which to recommend. It's such a great touchstone for other things. So if you see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and then you also see the original Stepford Wives, you put those two movies in a blender, you get Out.
I had never thought of that combination, but now I will.
You know, there are things about the imagery and the ideas behind both of those movies that were so evident to me when I saw Get Out that I just, if you really like that movie, you should watch Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and The Stepford Wives, if only to see those same ideas done two other ways.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about a long career like Hepburn's, because again, you have hidden gems and you have so many films along the way, and you start thinking about how the career builds and also frankly how films relate to each other over time. So I really like what you're doing here in the sense of, you know, in a kind of really fascinating way, linking together various films. And, you know, a hidden gem, Alice Adams is not a great film, but it deserves, you know, more viewing, you know, more recognition. Some of those films from the early 30s, they're not always great films, but she's great, you know, and watch to see her as she's just emerging as a movie actor.
You know, I'm sure most of her fame comes from people having seen her in the movies, actually going to the movies to see her when they were actually on the screen. But for me, I discovered her in Spencer Tracy movies. They were on late at night. And so, you know, you tune in, you see that it would be those two together, and you think, okay, I know what we're in for. It's going to be some sort of battle of the sexes. But another gem I would mention is one of that they did called Desk Set from 57, just because the setting is so antiquated. You know, this computer is going to come and change everything, and it's so huge, it's almost comical. But it's the kind of thing that you watch on late night TV and you're like, oh wow, look at how things were back then, and look what we used to think of what computer technology was going to do to us all.
It's a point you and I have often made in our show together. You watch a movie like Desk Set, and it's so much about office life and just life in America in the 50s, isn't it?
I mean, it is.
About how the characters are dressed, how the office is decorated, the value system. And that's a case where, you know, if it's a really good film, a lot of the value, the worth of it is that. I mean, that's not just background trappings, you know what I mean? I mean, the background is sort of the foreground in some ways as to what it's saying about American culture.
Yeah, and then in some ways, even though it seems very antiquated and quaint, still timeless.
Well, that's the attribute of any great work of art that, you know, as Ezra Pound would say, it's news that stays news. So it may be a period piece in various ways, or for us a period piece because it was made so long ago, but it still somehow registers and resonates for us.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we'll see you at the movies.
See you there.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.